Welcome to the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio. Thanks for listening this week. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Well, we're still in the middle of a pandemic, but that did not keep Florida voters from going to the polls this week. Instead, hundreds of thousands of you changed how you cast your ballot. Yeah, this week's August primary saw an enormous jump in vote-by-mail ballots in Florida, and Democrats got a lead over Republicans. Total voter turnout around the state was the highest of any presidential primary in Florida, Tom, since 1992. Voter energy is out there.
It certainly is, right? It has been turned up, and the voter turnout and results in congressional primaries and some local elections that crowded our ballots in Florida have some Florida Democrats growing more confident into the November election. For instance, four Democratic members of the congressional delegation from South Florida all survived primary challenges from more progressive challengers. You know, the results, of course, Melissa, come the same week that Joe Biden and Kamala Harris became the official presidential and vice presidential nominees for Democrats.
That's right. And of course, their convention was held virtually. The first time the television audiences watched something like that unfold over a convention week. Everything is being driven by the pandemic right now, of course. And later on in the hour, we will talk about how that has affected the reopening of Florida schools. But first, this Friday on the Florida Roundup, we are taking a look at presidential politics as Democrats gear up, hoping to win Florida in November. Wherever you stand politically, we want you to give us a call. It's 305-995-1800. Tweets to at Florida Roundup.
Nick Harris was supposed to be in Milwaukee this week with other Florida delegates to the Democratic National Convention. Instead, she stayed in Broward County as the convention went virtual because of the pandemic. She was a delegate for Joe Biden, joins us now. Nick, welcome to the Florida Roundup. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So Florida delegates told me this week that they wanted to come out of this convention with a couple of things, a sense of unity, a big tent Democratic Party. I heard that term over and over again speaking with your fellow delegates. Do you think the convention accomplished that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I thought the convention was incredibly effective. Yes, it would have been wonderful to be in Milwaukee. But it gave folks a clear contrast between the candidates. And let's just be honest, Michelle Obama and her husband made a compelling case against Donald Trump. And I felt like Kamala and Joe really rounded out the evening by providing hope, giving some meat to the communities they know they need to turn out, specifically black folks, addressing systemic racism in this country. And I think we've given compelling reasons to this country that it's clear you either want America and where we've been going, or you want a new change, you want hope, you want love.
You know, this is an election where few people are on the fence, even 70-some-odd days out. Choices have been made. What messages do you think resonated for those independents, those non-committal, or for that matter, Trump voters who voted in 16 but are reconsidering that vote now? What policy messages do you think really the convention delivered on?
Well, I think that's a great point, and I love that when it finished last night, I had so many calls, messages from friends who are MPAs. Here's what I thought we did effectively last night. Bloomberg, you have a lot of people, even when I talk to Trump supporters.
Yeah, Michael Bloomberg, the former mayor of New York City.
Michael Bloomberg and MPAs who keep saying, but I like what the market is doing. I like the economy. I think the message that was sent was that Donald Trump inherited an economy that was already successful. And when we look at the number of jobs that have still been lost, so this economy hasn't recovered, but the market is. Mm-hmm. And so what we're saying is you're not going to lose that with Donald Trump. I thought Michael Bloomberg did a great job to say, this is not the president. This is not the person we want controlling the economy. So I think that really spoke to a lot of MPAs. And then how many times did you hear Joe Biden last night talk about love, talk about decency, talk about what do you want to see in the White House? And I think that speaks to a lot of MPAs who can understand the economy is not going to leave because we vote in, you know, Joe Biden. I think we can do better because our markets can depend on us to be consistent, but also the fact that we have decency back in the White House. I watched the young man that spoke last night, and I just thought about how many parents were watching that saying, is Donald Trump really who you want your kids being as the president of the United States? I think the answer is no.
This was the young teenager from Archer, I think, who is a stutterer and spoke about his encounter with the candidate, Vice President Biden, in New Hampshire during the primary. The vice president also has a stuttering issue, grew up with a stuttering issue and addressed it. Let me ask you, the other idea that I heard from Florida delegates during the convention was not only this idea of unity, but they needed energy. Right. Especially after 2016, they needed energy. And in Florida, especially, there were no big crowds. Right. There was no loud applause. There was no balloon drop. How do you think this virtual experience energized rank and file Democrats?
Going into it, I was concerned about that. And I'm a Democrat and I'm a huge supporter of Biden. I was worried about low energy, but boy, did they prove us wrong. They put together a production, and brought folks from all walks of life. We had folks, progressive, all across the board. I thought they did a great job as much as possible. I think everybody now is used to Zoom, so it didn't seem so strange to have the boxes pop up and people clapping. We were clapping in my living room. Yeah. And so to see that they were able to really turn this virtual event into something that felt tangible, something I felt like I was really there and a part of it. And every night I couldn't believe how many people were writing me saying I'm tuning in, and I don't usually watch the convention.
Nick, hold on the line.
I usually watch it.
I want a caller here to join us. Nick Harris, a Biden delegate for the Democratic National Convention, is with us from Broward County. Matthew in Jacksonville is joining us. Matthew, go ahead.
Yes, I just had a quick comment. I disagree with Joe Biden a lot on policy issues. I'm a progressive, but I just want to say that everyone I know, including myself, we're voting for Joe Biden because the alternative is a fascist. And I don't have any reservations about saying that. He's an authoritarian.
Do you have any reservations about voting for Vice President Biden?
I mean, not really. I don't agree with his policy positions, but I feel that him and Kamala Harris have done a great job laying out their positions.
Matthew, I appreciate that. Thanks for joining us from Jacksonville. Nick, I do want to ask you about watching this election. What was that like for you, Kamala Harris being the first woman of color, the first black woman to appear on a major political party candidacy ticket? What was it like for you watching this happen as a black woman?
For me, it moved me to tears, and it surprised me a little bit because I didn't think I could ever have that feeling I felt with Barack. And I felt it there to realize not only is this a black woman, also I attended an HBCU, Florida A&M University, our largest HBCU in the state of Florida. So the shout out that she gave to HBCUs, to AKAs, just really for me, not only did we have a black woman, but it was a black woman speaking to my community, speaking directly to me. And I could not be prouder. I hope that this continues, that America shows up to vote and say, we see you, we hear you, we're prepared for the tough conversations. And I appreciate that Kamala said, we're going to have them. We're going to have those conversations and hopefully do better in our country.
Nick, thank you for joining us and sharing your perspective with us as a Democratic National Convention delegate. A virtual delegate at that. Nick Harris with us from Broward County. Thanks, Nick.
Well, Nancy Soderberg served as a Biden delegate to the DNC this week from Jacksonville. Soderberg is a former ambassador and a top-ranking staffer on the National Security Council during the Clinton administration. Nancy, good to have you on the show. You know, we're all living in a Zoom world these days. What was the virtual experience like for you as a delegate?
Well, first, thanks, Melissa, for having me, and Tom, it's a great show. I always try and tune in. I have been involved in politics for many decades and have been to most of the conventions since 1984, and no one knew what to expect here. Normally, the parties are the main issue there, and it's the side conversations, and just being all together is a very powerful, energizing. The purpose of these conventions is no longer to decide who's going to be the nominee. The last brokered convention was in 1954. So it's really to launch the enthusiasm to get out the vote, showcase the president, set the themes, and launch the general election. And to my huge surprise, that is exactly what this surprisingly managed to do. We came together. It was exciting. For me, I thought we were going to initially, as a delegate, for Biden for the Democrats from Florida, I thought we were going to all be in little Zoom boxes. I mean, there was a lot of side Zoom boxings. We started with breakfast with the Florida delegation and had many exciting people come in and talk to us. We even had a chance to talk to Vice President Biden, zoomed into this a couple of days ago to just give a pep talk. But it was much more than just sort of side conversations on Zooms. It was a national showcase for who the Democratic Party is and who Joe Biden is. It was diverse. It was extraordinary, zooming in to various cities around the world and putting together a really showcase of who we are as a party, young, old, disabled, dynamic, and then bringing in some Republicans like Colin Powell to endorse the president. And it showed the variety. Democrats are not monolithic. We've got, you know, AOC to Colin Powell now supporting them. It couldn't be more diverse. And so I think what it did was set the themes that Joe Biden's a unifier, that we have the energy and the dynamism to get out the vote in November. And I think it's a tough act for the Republicans to follow next week. We'll see what they do.
We will see how their convention proceeds. I mean, the DNC was very smoothly produced, given, I think, the challenge of turning this all out virtually and moving into these uncharted waters. As we talk with delegates to the Democratic Convention, we'll continue with Nancy Soderberg, and let's bring in Rebecca in Clearwater on the phone. Rebecca, go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a longtime Democrat. My family were all Democrats, and so there was no choice as to who we were going to vote for. We were all very disappointed last election when Hillary, you know, lost in the end. Yes, everything that your previous callers stated was very well put together. I mean, everything that the DNC tried to do, they did it. They brought in the right speakers. There were hardly any missteps that were notable. I'm more energized, more excited to vote for Biden and Harris than ever.
Thank you for that, Rebecca. Certainly both parties, that's the goal of their conventions, Nancy, to get the voters energized. Now, let me ask you about your corner of the state, North Florida. A robust Democratic turnout this week in the Florida primary among Democrats. Now, this is a part of the state that has trended Republican for many years, but it's starting to edge to a more blue cast. So how important is Jacksonville and the northern part of Florida to the Biden-Harris campaign as they seek to win in this swing state in November?
It's absolutely critical. And don't forget that Duval went blue in the last election cycle of 2018. So Democrats are fired up, motivated. We've got Donna Deegan running against John Rutherford, and she's beloved here and is going to drive huge turnout. And I'm a trustee of the Florida Democratic Party, and we have, over the last 2 years, built an unprecedented infrastructure that is registering voters, protecting voters. We've registered 680-some-odd thousand more registered Democrats who've requested vote-by-mail ballots than Republicans. We're motivated, and I think Trump is going to hit a huge blue wall in trying to turn Florida red. If we win in Florida, President Trump cannot win re-election. So Florida, as always, is ground zero for who's going to be the next president. And the Democratic Party and the Biden campaign are very focused on massive voter turnout from Jacksonville down through Miami. And if we get the vote out here in Jacksonville and drive turnout here, we will win Florida. And so it's important that everybody register to vote. My one message today to the listeners would be, make sure that you register to vote, that you make a plan to vote. We're going to expect chaos on Election Day. So get your absentee ballot in. If you want to vote in person, go the first day of early voting. Don't wait till the last minute, because we're expecting massive chaos driven by this president, who wants to make sure that it's chaotic and people don't go vote. So don't let that happen. Make a plan to vote and go vote.
Let's go to Winston quickly on the line in West Palm Beach. Hi, Winston. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
Thank you for taking my call. Well, I just want to say that I watched the convention from the top to the bottom, and I had chills going through my body, because we heard a lot about what we should have been hearing about. for a long time, and that is the love that we used to have. We need love among people, and especially for the children and our children's children watching television. And then the leader of our country degrades women and minorities and handicapped people. It's not good for our future, of our children. So I think last night was a great start. There was a lot of love floating around, which is what we need. And I want to urge any Republican that listens to this, please, please, I understand you are Republican, but think about your kids and your future first before the party and think about the country.
Thank you, Winston. Yeah, Winston, thank you. Nancy Soderbergh, we're almost out of time, but certainly Joe Biden and Kamala Harris are trying to reach out to moderate and disaffected Republicans. In the minute or so we have left before the break, let me ask you, that is a challenge because party identification is still very powerful in this country.
Yes, it is. And we also have to, you know, energize our more liberal side, get the centers, bring some Republicans back. And the critical is going to be women who voted for Trump last time are beginning to shift back. So the message here is one of unity, competence, and empathy. And I think the contrast that you're going to see with the convention this week and the one next week, which is going to be more divisive, more partisan, and driving that dark message. And I think the message that the vice president put forward and his whole team and vice president nominee Kamala Harris is one of, we got your back, we understand your needs, and we will fight for you. This is always an election about who feels the person in power will fight for them.
And you predicted chaos on Election Day in Florida. Can you really quickly explain what you meant by that?
Well, I think the president has launched a campaign against mail-in ballots, and we don't know exactly what the post office is going to do. We know that he's trying to sow division, sow chaos, and this false narrative that mail-in ballots are susceptible to fraud when there is zero evidence that that is the case. But that message implies they're going to pull every trick. I think they're going to try and challenge absentee ballots at the voter box. Justice Department and bar is trying to lay the groundwork that we're going to have to question that. So to all the voters, don't leave it to the last minute. Make sure you mail in your ballot. You can go online and verify that it's been counted and correct problems if there isn't, and you can go early voting so that there's long lines. On Election Day, you can avoid those. So I think you're going to see long lines. They're closing ballot. They're closing polling places. They're sowing disconcerting messages about false narratives that mail-in voting is not safe, secure. So get out there early, register to vote, and make sure that you don't get caught up in the chaos that I think will happen on Election Day. Go early and vote by mail early if you can.
She is former ambassador, NSC staffer, and delegate to the DNC, Nancy Soderbergh. Nancy, thanks for being with us here on the Florida Roundup.
Great show. Love your show.
Thanks so much. Don't go away, everyone. When we come back, we'll keep taking your calls about the DNC and how you think Florida voters might swing this fall. Also, kids head back to class across the state in this pandemic. What are your thoughts about that here on the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio, 305-995-1800, and tweet us at Florida Roundup. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. Thanks for being with us this Friday. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville.
And I'm Tom Hudson in Miami, talking about politics. Florida's primary August election now in the books. The Democratic National Convention made history this week, nominating the first major political party, becoming the first major political party to nominate a black woman as vice president. And it was the first major political convention held virtually. Next week, the Republican National Convention is up. It will be held and make history itself Among the many ways, President Trump will make his acceptance speech on Thursday night from the White House, the first time a sitting president has done that for a political convention. 305-995-1800, 305-995-1800. Susan McGrath is with us, a Joe Biden delegate to the DNC this week from St. Petersburg. She's a former chair of the Pinellas County Democrats. Susan, thanks for holding on and joining us here on the Roundup. Susan, are you with us via FaceTime audio?
Well, as we try to
think that Susan is with us.
Yeah, but
so we'll reconnect with her.
You know, we're getting a lot of tweets into the show, Tom, while we try to get Susan back on the line about the Democratic convention that we've been talking about as we speak with Florida delegates to the DNC. Here's one from a listener. I thought it was boring, like a long infomercial. Not enough hard hitting energy. And if it weren't for the Obamas, it would have been a mess. And I'm a liberal Democrat. But then they give the hashtag Biden-Harris 2020. And here is a tweet from Monique. My husband and I are voting for Joe Biden. Let us know who will get your vote, Florida. It's 305-995-1800 as we talk politics here on the show.
So there were many remarkable things, I thought, that happened, not just the confluence of things, Melissa, this week in politics in Florida, right? The Democratic National Convention and certainly the role Florida is going to play. Also, the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment coming on Election Day in Florida.
That's right.
And, you know, what we saw in terms of turnout in Florida.
Hello, Ms.
Impressive by historic standards, although still less than 30% or so in some places. But nonetheless, a big jump in voter turnout compared to 4 years ago during the August primary, which tells us, right, that folks are certainly paying attention to local politics. And the hope is for the major political parties that is going to translate into more participation, more turnout for that core for both Republicans and Democrats as we move into November.
Yeah. And, you know, when you look at the vote by mail numbers, it's interesting because in Florida for decades, the Florida Republican Party has absolutely perfected its get out the vote by mail turnout effort. They turn their voters out, and Florida Republicans know well to vote early and vote by mail. Then the pandemic hit, and we saw the complicating factor of President Trump trying to discredit vote by mail. And even though he reversed himself recently via a tweet and said, oh, actually, voting by mail in Florida is fine, you did see on this primary election day across the state, more Democrats than ever before casting their votes by mail. So there's a partisan split now in Florida as to how people are looking at voting by mail in a pandemic. We saw fewer Republicans voting by mail. That may have been because of comments by the president, but it may also have been because of their fears of voting in person in a pandemic. And we saw more Democrats than ever before taking advantage of mailing in those ballots. And so it was a bit of a harbinger as to what we might be able to expect in November if we are still voting in large numbers by mail, because the partisan tilt on that is changing somewhat in this state. So that's been fascinating to look at.
It is. And to see what kind of get out the vote effort both political parties will be able to stage during a pandemic, during this kind of phased reopening throughout Florida, is going to be a place to watch. Let's go to Sarasota. Phil has been chiming in here. Phil, thanks for calling in. Go ahead.
Hey, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to mention that what I've heard on your show so far is really that, in essence, what people are saying is that the Republicans are mean-spirited people. It's not the case. Most Republican people out there have good hearts, and they want to see good things for our country. I'd like to point out that the vast majority of people in our country focus on Donald Trump's emotional issues. And we all know that he's got a problem, especially when he picks on somebody who's physically handicapped. That's a terrible thing to do. But I think as a country, we need to look a little bit deeper and understand that what our president is trying to do is save this country by making better deals with other countries, for example, China. It's not if Joe
Do you
Biden
think we have a better deal with China today than we did 4 years ago, Phil?
Not necessarily 4 years ago, but 8 years ago when President Obama made a deal with China, it was terrible. The bottom line is we were selling our soul to the Chinese. Trump's trying to correct that.
What have you seen? How has the deal with China that the president has affected you and your community?
Unfortunately, I don't have specifics, but I know that when it comes to the bottom line, that financially, our president is making a better deal with countries that's going to be in favor of America.
Okay. Phil, let me ask you, what are you looking forward to hearing from the RNC, the Republican National Convention, in the coming week?
What I'm looking forward to hearing is some concrete ways in which our country is going to get back to work. That's the number one thing that must happen in this country.
Gotcha. Specificity is what you're looking for. Phil, I appreciate you adding your voice here to our conversation. Phil calling in there from Sarasota.
Well, there is one group in Florida still fighting for their right to cast a ballot. It's the state's nearly 1 million residents with a prior felony conviction. Desmond Mead of the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition led the fight for Amendment 4 here. Voters approved it in 2018. It restored voting rights to former felons. As the fight over 4 continues in court, Mead himself voted Tuesday for the first time in decades.
For the first time in over 30 years, cast the ballot and felt like a complete citizen again. There was a lot of emotions that went through me, though. You know, just thinking about people that have sacrificed their lives so, you know, folks can enjoy the right to vote. And even for the folks that, you know, the family members and friends and loved ones who overwhelmingly voted in favor of Amendment 4 so people like me can have a second chance of experiencing what democracy is all about.
Now, Mead was able to vote Tuesday just as a federal appeals court heard oral arguments over Amendment 4. Here's what's going on. After voters approved the amendment in 2018, the state legislature passed a law stating that felons in Florida must first pay all outstanding fines and fees before they can cast a ballot. Critics have called that a poll tax. A final decision in this case may ultimately be appealed all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, and it could have significant political implications in this, the nation's largest swing state. It's still unclear if the court will make a decision, though, before the November election. So we'll continue to watch Amendment 4 and how this plays out.
Move on to schools and reopening and the pandemic. Closing arguments are happening virtually this hour in a closely watched lawsuit involving the reopening of Florida public schools. A Leon County judge is expected to decide by next week if Florida's executive order mandating that school buildings reopen by the end of August creates an unsafe environment. The testimony revealed deep divides among parents, teachers, Florida school boards, and the State Board of Education about what's safe, what's not safe, in terms of public in-class education during a pandemic. Andrew Atterbury reports for Politico and is covering education in Florida. He joins us now on the telephone. Andrew, welcome back to the Roundup. Thanks for your time.
Hey, happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
So let's walk through quickly this case. Kind of at the heart of it is what's safe in the classroom for teachers and for students. As you've watched the arguments this week, what can you tell us about what the judge is weighing in terms of safety for teachers and students?
Well, as you talked about earlier, it really showed the divide among people who are split over whether or not students should be sent back to the classroom. You know, for every person that the teachers union brought up, the state brought up someone who had, you know, a different opinion on why they think things should be open. And for the state, it all comes down to choice. They say that 1.6 million students have signed up for face-to-face classes, and if this lawsuit prevails, then that will get turned down, and those people will lose their choice, right? But then the teachers argue that they don't have a choice, that they're the ones who have to be in classrooms no matter what. And even if they, you know, their teachers are asking for leave across the state, that's getting denied. Teachers are leaving the profession. And even in some cases, school leaders say that if teachers end up in quarantine, as long as they're healthy, they'll still have to be streaming their classes to students online. So that just kind of shows you why teachers feel like this is an unsafe environment for them.
The executive order that is the heart of this lawsuit talked about the decision to open up school buildings by the end of August was mandated except under the advice of the Department of Health offices if they gave separate advice. What role does the local health department, which are branches of the state agency, what role are they playing in this lawsuit and really in this kind of decision matrix?
Well, the FDA lawyers, what they say is that the local health officials have been missing in action because when school districts have called upon them, for by and large, the health officials have said, well, we're not the ones who can tell you whether or not it's appropriate to close. But in other cases, local school boards have had their own health panels that weren't the actual Department of Health, but they were local doctors and physicians. And like in Hillsborough County, for example, they said, we advise you to keep schools online. Hillsborough has been a famous example now in this lawsuit because they went ahead and said they were going to start the school year online, and the Department of Education shut that down and said, no, you need to go in person by August 31st.
Well, Hillsborough first said they were going to start somewhat in class and then decided, no, we're going to go online. And that's when the state stepped in and said, no, we approved the plan that had you guys back in the building.
Yep, and that is exactly what the FDA lawyers are trying to point out, that this isn't actually a local decision. That violates the Constitution. School boards should have that authority. But then, of course, the state says, okay, if you take out this order, then online classes in general won't be able to count for your attendance, and you'll lose state money that way.
Yeah. So what are the options in front of the judge in this case in terms of a ruling? Number one, the executive order sets the deadline for districts to do this by the end of August. That is approaching very, very quickly here. So it's kind of either next week or no decision at all. What are the options for the judge?
Well, what he wants them to, he wants each side to put out their own order so what they think should happen. And as you mentioned earlier, that the final arguments are happening right now. And what the teachers union wants is basically him to throw out the order and say that schools don't have to reopen and it should be a local decision. But that would also mean that there may have to be some additions to how schools are funded because there isn't really a provision in law now that they can be online.
And some schools are already back in the classroom, Andrew, and some of those classrooms, some of those school districts, Baker County, Bradford, Martin counties, have all seen students under quarantine as they've gone back into the classroom. Are those lessons being debated, being brought up here in this case?
They are, but the state's main argument is, quarantines are expected to happen, and this is how it's supposed to be. And they said that they're still warning against closing campuses down wholesale. They say quarantine a classroom, quarantine a bus route. This is what the governor said earlier this week. Closing down a school should be your last option, and you should be quarantining, people who come into contact with this and doing your contact tracing.
Andrew Atterbury is watching those closing arguments while speaking with us here live on this Friday afternoon. He's education reporter with Politico. Thanks, Andrew.
Hey, thank you all.
You are listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio.
And as that court fight plays out, some parents around Florida have chosen virtual learning for their kids this term. Others decided to send their children back to brick and mortar classrooms. Still others are just calling for more options. Adam Herman of Hollywood, Florida is one such parent. He's on the line. Hi, Adam.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Good to have you on the show. You're part of a group, thousands strong on Facebook, Broward Parents for Return to School. Tell us about your family's situation and why it's led you to call for more options for in-person instruction in South Florida.
Well, I have a 10th grader, an 8th grader, and a 4th grader. And they've all this week began their schooling virtual and online. And we have been fighting for the option to have choice since June with our school board and Superintendent Runcie. We as parents believe that the right place for our children to be is in the brick and mortar school, and we'd like them to be there.
And certainly plenty of other parents feel the way you do, although others are concerned about the spread of the virus. The school system where you are is saying it's simply not safe to reopen yet. What's your response to that argument?
Well, I think the statistics clearly show that it is safe to reopen. It's just a question of having choice. Everything we do in life involves risk, whether we get in our car, whether we're walking down the street. There are risk involved with our children staying home and being in front of a screen 8 to 10 hours a day. So we need to evaluate those risks and decide what's best for our children. And again, we're not calling for everybody to have to be back in school or every teacher to be back in school. We're calling for the option to have choice to make the decision that's best for our children and families. And right now, we don't have that choice.
Some districts have gone to a hybrid learning model where some kids are in class for part of the week and then they do virtual other days. Is that something that you wish your district would perhaps look at?
Well, the hybrid model was something that they were looking up at until the middle of July. And at that point, the numbers were actually significantly higher than they are right now. For us, the hybrid model is no better than, you know, than 100% virtual e-learning. Let me correct myself. It's better from a social standpoint because they get to see their friends and be with their teachers 2 days a week as opposed to 5 days a week. But as far as from an exposure standpoint, for the majority of kids to be in school 2 days a week and then be in daycare 3 days a week just doesn't make sense. And it's also a very unworkable model for parents that are working or two-parent households that are working. The hybrid model just doesn't seem to make sense.
It has certainly been tough on working parents. So what kind of response have you gotten from school officials? Because you did take part in a demonstration this week in Fort Lauderdale.
Well, the response is pretty much, we hear what you're saying, but we're going to make our own decisions and we're going to define our own path here. They're looking at the numbers with respect to their health officials, and they're randomly picking numbers out of the air and saying, okay, we need 3 to 5%. CDC guidelines don't really call for any type of percentage, and the general thought is that it should be less than 10%, which is where it was at the end of June, and it's well below that now. But regardless, there doesn't seem to be any response from the school board or Superintendent Runcie other than, sorry, take it or leave it, this is the way it's going to be.
Well, Adam Herman of Hollywood, part of Broward Parents for the Return to School, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And people did cast ballots for school board this week around Florida, and this issue did play a role in how they voted. In a moment, we'll speak with a Florida teacher who went viral around the country after she published her own mock obit. Yes, as a way to protest being sent back into the classroom. Her story is coming up in just a few minutes here as we continue with the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. We will be right back in just a moment with your calls and tweets. We want to hear what you think about school issues. It's 305-995-1800. Tweets to @FloridaRoundup. Did you send your kids back to school this week, or did you opt for virtual learning? What is your family's situation? How are you dealing with this? I can tell you right now at my house, we have one child in virtual learning and one who went back to class, but only in the hybrid model. We'll be right back. We want to hear from you.
Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio. Thanks again for listening. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Well, a Florida teacher went viral this week when she published her own mock obituary as a way to protest schools reopening in Florida. 33-year-old Whitney Reddick is a special education teacher in Jacksonville. She did go back to class this week, even though she believes students and faculty would be safer with all virtual learning for now. In her mock obit published on Facebook, Whitney said, quote, "Even though she shouted from the rooftops, attempted to be unemotional, and educated herself on the facts and science, she succumbed to the ignorance of those in power," end quote. I spoke with Whitney Reddick Thursday after she had just finished her first day back in the classroom. Whitney Reddick, good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
What has this experience been like for you?
The teaching experience has been very different. The viral post has been humbling and very unexpected. So posting the obituary is not the first act of activism that I've done, and the other ones have not taken off how this one did. So it was not expected at all.
You wrote, "Whitney left us alone, while alone in isolation and on a ventilator at a Duval County hospital in Jacksonville. She was in her 33rd year." And you went on to say that despite you begging and pleading the people in charge to listen, they didn't, which sent all the teachers back into the classroom. You went back with your colleagues, despite your fears, and so many other teachers have done the same. How are you commiserating about this whole situation right now?
So I do want to point out that, yes, education is teachers, and we do play a big role, but I have two paraprofessionals that are with me in the classroom for the same amount of time all day. And, you know, we have bus drivers and cafeteria workers and our custodial staff that probably have a lot of pressure too. So I just want to point out that I was speaking on behalf of all of them and the worries that we all have as a collective educational community. my peers and I will say that the majority of them feel the exact same that I do. They have come to me in confidence or, you know, on the sly as we're walking, they're like, great job. I'm with you. And it's mm-hmm. like, you don't have to be ashamed that you have apprehension about going back into a classroom. I don't think that is anything to be shameful of. We share ideas. You know, I did a training on how I'm going to implement rituals and routines in my classroom and just things that I've really thought of because of the worry and the anxiety of not just keeping my family safe, but my students and the other peers that are in my room. A lot of our students have multi-generational homes and their primary caretaker would be in that high-risk category, and the thought of accidentally or unknowingly sending them home with a virus that could potentially be deadly is nerve-wracking and is scary, and that would really devastate me.
I would think it would be a lot tougher to teach effectively with this kind of anxiety and worry.
So I do want to point out that even though the anxiety and the worry is there, and I think about it, today was obviously our first day back. And from the time I was in the classroom with the students to the time that they got on their bus or they left in the car to go home, I only thought about keeping them safe. That initial worry of, you know, am I going to do it right? How am I going to do it? All of that kind of left. And I just instinctively got into a rhythm. And so did the other adults in my classroom. Obviously, keeping them apart and mask and all of those things are a given that are very difficult. But I really, the anxiety wasn't with me today. It is now. I think about it now.
But, yeah, now that the day's over. But the kids stuck on to their masks and followed the rules that for the most part, it sounds like.
So I do want to point out, I do teach a special education population at a center school. So all of our students have special needs and they are in the most restrictive environment. Obviously, if they need help hand washing, we're doing that constantly. And we're using the hand sanitizer if we're unable to get to a sink or what have you. So we're, as adults, taking on that hand-over-hand washing with the student if they need assistance with that. But the mask and the shields, that's something that we're going to work on and that every child, I have no doubt, will eventually get to a place where they're comfortable with.
We'll get to that place. In the meantime, the Florida Education Association has sued over the mandate to go back to class. I know mm-hmm. that you would prefer all virtual school for now. Is that mm-hmm. what you've indicated before? Is that where you still are?
I hate that question is so hard. Yeah, I mean, yes, after seeing them today and just there were times that tears just welled up in my eyes because I do miss it and I miss them and they miss each other or just being here. And I do still feel that it is the safest opportunity for everyone if it was 100% virtual start. Yeah, I do still stand by that. Yes.
Clearly, the science says that, too. But as you point out, the emotions around this are tough for everyone involved. Kids who've missed the social interaction, parents mm-hmm. who feel that their kids will do better in school. Mm-hmm. It's such a tough issue, and you are right at the center of it. So what's your message to the state of Florida right now as we get through this first week of school?
I think at the moment is, hearing, you know, yes, the socialization and stuff like that, but I was wearing a mask, a scrub cap, a face shield, and then a disposable robe or bib thing, you know, where your front is covered, your arms are covered. And I have a student who I have not had in my classroom specifically, but he has been at the school where I am at for as long as I've been here. And he and I have a special bond, and today whenever someone walked in, they're like, it's Miss Raddick. She gets to be your teacher this year. And he did a side eye at me and a glance, and she was like, hey, it's Miss Raddick. And he was like, And then eventually, you know, I had to pull up the face shield. I had to step really far back and, you know, say his name a few times. So, yes, the socialization is important. However, I think being able to see me and in not such a scary form would be better. And that's online. So really, I'm I feel that the people that are using that as an argument, and not yourself, just other people that are using that as an argument to return, don't truly understand what that means and what that entails. Socialization is playing with your friends on a playground. And all I did was say, hey, guys, you can't be on the tire swing together. Okay, back up. You know, like, that's not socialization. And we have to keep everybody safe. That is my number one priority. That is my school's number one priority.
15 seconds, I got your mic open.
Online is best until it is safe.
Whitney Reddick, it's so good to talk to you. And thank you for your bravery and your service to kids and for sharing your story with us. We really appreciate it.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
You're listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio.
Take your phone calls about the reopening of schools in Florida. Some counties have reopened in the building. Other counties have opened virtually. Other counties are still to come. Jeffrey in Orlando is joining us. Go ahead, Jeffrey. You're on the Roundup. Jeffrey, you're live. Try to get rid of that delay that you're listening to us on the radio there with our friends at WMFE. Jeffrey, can you hear us?
Did you see this tweet coming in, Tom? People are tweeting the show about how they're dealing with school. Here's Emily on Twitter. There are glitches. It's frustrating, but I feel like my kids' schools are doing their best. They're being strict on masks. Lots of frustration at home with virtual. Little kids just do better with a human being, but we can wait it out. You know, I think that sums it up, doesn't it? What are you doing with your kids, Tom?
Well, we are not in school yet. Our school doesn't start until August 31st. Uh-huh. School in Miami-Dade County was pushed back by a week. I have two kids in public schools here, in high school and middle school. And next week, we have a big orientation week ahead where, at least in our household, Melissa, we have set this is the tech check. Right?
Yeah.
You and I have worked together a long time, and you know how I like to do tech checks to make sure all the technology is working right. And that's what we're going to do with the two kids, to make sure they've got all the applications, that they know how to use the mute button, they know how to turn on the camera. One of the things that they've decided to do here in South Florida, for instance, attendance is always a question when going online for virtual. And they're requiring the camera to be on for the students because that's how they're going to be taking attendance. Now, that does bring up a lot of questions, particularly around the digital divide that exists in a lot of our communities. We're lucky enough in our household to be able to have the wherewithal to do this. But we know for so many students, so many teachers, and so many families, that digital divide is a real problem and a real difficulty in terms of trying to get up and get up and online.
Oh, yeah.
And to do it in a way that is sustainable and that isn't interfering with a child's education.
I know.
Right?
In Duval County, in Jacksonville, they distributed laptops to every child that asked for one and set up hotspots, too, because there's so much poverty in parts of Jacksonville and so many families that don't have laptops, computers, internet access of any kind. So school districts are stepping up in an unprecedented fashion here in this crisis, which has really been remarkable to watch how they are trying to meet all of these needs in such a short time frame, too. You know, it's just unbelievable what we're living through. I think we're so busy just getting through each day, all of us, that we're not taking a step back and reflecting on these momentous times that we are in right now.
Yeah, and finding the understanding for our own kids, for friends, for just community members who are dealing with the pandemic in so many different ways and in so many different shapes, that it becomes a real test of empathy, understanding, and patience.
Yes, which we can all use more of. We'll try to keep that top of mind. And that is our show. The Florida Roundup is produced by WJCT Public Media in Jacksonville and WLRN Public Media in Miami. Heather Schatz and Denise Royal are the producers.
Jason Zabka is the WLRN Director of Radio Programming. The WLRN Director of Radio Operations is Peter Maritz. He's also our Technical Director this hour. We get engineering help each and every week from Doug Peterson, Charles Michaels, and Josh Torres. Our theme music is provided by Miami jazz guitarist Aaron Libos at AaronLibos.com. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Melissa Ross. Have a great weekend. Keep those masks on. Stay safe. We'll be back next Friday at noon.